You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more. Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith and I'm going to start under these extraordinary circumstances with a quick shout out to everyone that's joined the Insiders Club in the last week since the world has been on fire. A huge love to Charlie Dunlop, BJ Mander, Yuka Talvio, Stuart Jordan, Ned Baker, Anna Bryson, Chris Davies and Rob Chapman, all of whom have signed on as new subscribers at a time when the live comedy circuit is transforming painfully into something very different and very not live. And there's an awful lot of economic uncertainty amongst all the self-employed, amongst everyone, but specifically those of us who aren't salaried in any way. So I just wanted to say a huge thank you to all of those. And as well, an extra special mention to Jenny Stringleman, Natalie Hargrave and Andres Purdy, all of whom upped their existing donations. I'm so knocked out by that, not just in terms of paying my rent, but just as a gesture, I really, really appreciate that. So thank you very much to those. If you would like to join the Insiders Club, you can do that at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. There has never been a better time to join, not to mention the fact that you're going to get a load of extras, over 30 minutes of extras from this forthcoming episode, forthcoming in the sense of any second now, with the brilliant Desiree Birch. She's so wonderful. I didn't know her really well at all, and was so lucky to be working with her at the Cape Town Comedy Festival. Desiree is from LA and has been sort of resident, semi-resident in the UK, living between America and the UK for a while now. She kind of made a real impact on me. I saw her poster, which we'll talk about later on, her poster for her first ever show, which was her face. And if you looked closely, you realised it was made up of hundreds of tiny dick pics. That's the kind of comic mind we're dealing with, which is not to in any way downplay her phenomenal writing ability, her fluency, and how incredibly articulate she is. And just as well, because she talks very fast. We're going to get stuck into this conversation about the protective shell of comedy, finding acceptance but to white standards, and what it means to seek connection within comedy and within art and the world. And I think we could all use connection at the moment. You know, well, I'll talk to you in the post amble about the horrific and very frightening state of the world at the moment. All of us are currently just shaking our heads in disbelief and veering wildly between calm and terror. But in the meantime, the show must go on, not least because I need to eat. So with that in mind, here is an episode recorded a couple of weeks ago and consequently before we in Britain, at least, knew just how serious the pandemic was going to be. Let's take, if not a walk down memory lane, then a creative exploration of the sort you come here for with the fabulous Desiree Birch. Of your gigs been? We've only done two, but
yes. It's only two. That's right. I can't, you know, the whole comedy thing when you get lost and people are like, what'd you do yesterday? You're like, what was yesterday? I have to look at my diary. Like, I have no idea what is happening because our lives are so just sort of scattershot day and night, this and that. I think it's been two gigs so far. They've been good and interesting. I'm starting to sort of relax into the festival and being like, oh, yeah, that's right. They're here. I'm here because they want me. You know what I mean? Like,
oh, do you have that sense of, am I in the right place?
Yeah, I mean, less so, but also always, you know, like there is that thing that I'm always honored to be on podcasts like this because I'm a comedian. I think I'm a good comedian, but there are times when I'm like, am I a comedian?
And sure, yeah,
you know,
yeah,
and
yeah.
I wonder how many of us have that sort of sense about it because...
My pet theory is all of us apart from Jimmy Carr. I honestly think that all of us at some point...
apart from probably Jimmy.
Yeah, exactly.
I think he did weigh down somewhere
in a compartment, in a drawer, in a room, in a safe somewhere. I had that.
Perhaps.
Yeah, I think. But yeah, so they have been going well. I mean, I think that obviously the festival is building back up to, you know, because it was on a hiatus. And so I think, you know, the audiences are figuring out what the heck is going on and we're figuring them out. It's great to be doing comedy in a place that is diverse in a lot of different senses. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we both work a lot in the UK and other places. And, you know, London audiences are one thing. And, you know, anywhere else in the UK is a different thing.
Sure.
And so it's honestly, it's really nice. Like, whenever I go back to the States, I usually fly back into New York, not always, but usually. And so it's just that thing of being on the tube and seeing, you know, and being like, okay, I'm brown, and going onto the subway in New York and being like, no one in here is white.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, and it's just a different, it's a thing that I don't realize that I am thirsty for or miss until I get it. And I go, oh yeah. And it's not necessarily even about like, oh, everyone's like me. I think that comedy's better when not everyone's like you, but when everybody is sort of mixed and people are responding to different things. Like, people respond differently to you at different times and they're listening to each other respond to you. And that sort of creates the triangle of the conversation of, yes, like, you know, I start to understand more about what I'm not laughing at and somebody else is, and I now understand more about them without having had that conversation yet. It's sort of an entree into conversations about things, which is why I think comedy is a good way to help facilitate those. So anyway, that is a long aside to say the festival's been going well and I'm easing into it a little bit more. I'm like, oh, that's right, I get to play around with what I'm doing this week, and so like I'll change it up tonight or, you know, whatever.
Yeah. So something that will be immediately apparent to the listener is that you are on turbo, right? Yeah. You talk fast, right?
I talk fast and too much and I don't breathe. And so, you know, my voice could benefit from that.
Do you feel you talk too much or do you feel that you talk the appropriate amount?
I don't know that I talk too much. I think that I don't. I think that this, the way that I speak is a holdover from, I mean, everything about our personality is a holdover from like our youth and our trauma and all that other stuff. But I think that I tend to, once I get the reins, hold on to them because I don't necessarily trust that if I allow for even a breath that I will continue to have them. I think part of that is the general thing of being a woman and being sort of like not listened to, cut off, whatever, la la la, that sort of la la la. But like we've all sort of talked about that a little bit, you know, and also being a middle kid that was just sort of like, I exist, like, and it's something that I would like to work on about myself because I would like to breathe more. I think that would be good for me as a human being and just for everything. And as a comic as well, because sometimes people really love that energy, but it's a thing that you have to ride, right? Because sometimes it's just enough and sometimes it's so much the words aren't coming out or they're not understanding or it seems like you're nervous or, you know, and it's all of those things, but it is about riding that, you know, it is its own drug, adrenaline, and that kind of thing that you're putting out when you do comedy, and you have to find your way of you know, writing it as opposed to letting it ride you.
Yes. Are there times when you feel it riding you?
Yeah. I think that, yeah, I you know, and it just depends on the night and the show. Sometimes, you know, obviously if you, the longer you've done comedy, the more you can play off any scenario and other people will be like, that was great. And you'll be like, yeah, okay. but you know, because for you, it's a thing of like, ah, oh, I let whatever was going on in my head or the timing or whatever the day get a hold of me more than I would have liked, to have done. And so I feel that I am someone who probably got into performance and comedy because, I mean, one, because I'm funny and that was a survival skill I developed pretty early on in life. And also because I, like many of us, am a secret control freak. And so as a comedian or an artist, writer, you know, actor, whatever, you get to control the narrative a bit more, right? And so if I'm putting the words out and the ideas out, I get to control the narrative about me. And I'm like, no, don't look at me the way that I can feel you looking at me. Look at me the way I'm telling you to look at me.
Yes. Yes, gotcha.
And sometimes that controlling thing, you know, it only takes you so far. It's, you know, it's rocket boosters. It gets you out there, but you can't orbit or be free or explore if you're constantly on that, you know, sort of...
Yes, you're launching. If yes. you're always trying to achieve escape launching. Velocity, yes. you're like that. Yeah. yeah, okay.
And it's like you've already escaped, and now you're just shooting off into nowhere, and soon you'll be out of the gravitational pull, and that's not what you want. It's not what we want. Like, we want you to hover around and be here. And so I think that learning anything takes a while, right? And sometimes you get it right and you're like, I got it. And then the next time you screw it up and you're like, okay, I guess I didn't get it. Like, you always have to prove over and over again that you've learned the thing or that you can further master or just exist in that thing. And so for me, I think that's one of the things that I want to grow in more as a performer is just the trust that I deserve to be here, which I know I do because I've been doing this, you know, in some form or another, like, you know, theater or solo performance comedy for like over half my life. But at the same time, there's like a 6-year-old who like doesn't know that yet. And I'm just like, bitch, get it together. Like, we got other stuff to do. So, yeah.
Have you made any conscious efforts or experiments to try to slow down? To like, or to do a gig where you go, okay, it's going to be escape velocity for 5 minutes, and then I'm going to change gear and see if you can achieve the same sort of impact with a different pace.
You know, that sounds like a good idea. No, I'm kidding. I have done so. I mean, sometimes it is about how you structure the set. Sometimes, you know, because you're mixing things, you know, and sometimes, usually the best anyone feels as a comic, and I'm probably generalizing, but one of the best times is when you're doing new material, right?
Oh, yeah.
Because it is the, like, failure is expected, right? And putting that in your mind of like, oh, you're gonna fail at some point or several points is great to just be like, okay, great, let's put all of that other, like, I need to make sure that I do this killing thing every single time or whatever. I need to be the best. I need to overachieve this gig, whatever it is in your head. Put that aside and be like, I'm really excited to say this one line. Like, I, you know, I've written all these things, but I'm really excited to say this thing. So I think that when I put the measures in place, sometimes it's about being like, okay, I know I need to start with something that makes them trust that they're going to have a good time and they're going to laugh, you know, and if you make them wait too long for that, then they're like, I don't know, mm-hmm. are you? And then you get to a place somewhere in the rhythm where you're like, okay, well, this bit, I don't know, I'm just trying it out. Let's see. I can play. I can talk to them and trying to, you know, structure in fun playtime in
yeah,
there,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
like, you know, parent yourself a little bit in it is good. I think the other time it happens is when you've done like an Edinburgh run or some other thing where you've done the thing a lot in a row and mm-hmm. it is in your muscles. And then at that point, you either know when the laughs tend to come, you know, and so you know that you can pause and rest in certain places. Like, you know where your pit stops are on the road trip that you're mm-hmm. on. And you're like, mm-hmm. oh, okay, I'm going to get to this place and then we'll sit there and have lunch. Or you're like, oh, I actually... It's when you've done a thing a million times and you're like, oh, I actually want to play here, you know, and remembering that it's play and remembering that it's comedy and remembering that it's funny for them or fun for them if it's funny and fun for you as well, as opposed to getting in that part of your head where yeah. it's like there are expectations to be met and I've got to do the big report at, you know, demonstration at the conference and this is you know, high stakes and, you know, like there's so many times when I have to be like, Desiree, it's not brain surgery. It like no one lives or dies. You yep. know, if you, you know, you don't even live or die, even if you die on stage. It's like, okay, you get a taxi right after the gig, you go home, you watch some Netflix, the next day is the next day. So, like, you know, just I have to do these weird sort of mechanisms in my head to be like, let's take it down a notch because this is supposed to be fun for you and me. I'm making this sound like it's so difficult, but, like, you know, it is comedy, but it is a thing that, like, you know, people either think, like, that's a job or, oh my God, I could never do that. You
yeah,
know, there's
yeah, okay.
like nothing in between. And I think it's up to us sometimes to be like, it can be in between sometimes. Like it can be, I'm going to work. I have good days at work. I have great days at work. I have bad days at work. I have horrible, never again days at work. And like all of those are going to come. So let's just be present for today and see what I can do today. And that's a good Zen mindset to have. I'd like to pretend I have that all the
sure,
time.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
I don't. I just need to remind myself to do that.
Yes. You know? That's a good kind of affirmation, isn't it?
To
kind of something that's like what I like about that is you're sort of seizing control, or it's an attempt to seize control of the absolute storm of one's personality in the storm of comedy, and like, you know, the massive lack of consistency or rhythm sometimes, you know, that it actually, it's nuts, as is life, but it's an examined life, and it's a projected, you know, performed, heightened kind of expression of life. It's nuts, and it's constantly zigging and zagging in every direction. So actually to have something of a mantra and go, this is a day at work, some days at work are good, some days at work are bad.
Yes.
That seems like a sensible...
And to put it back into a realm of that in which it makes sense, because it is you all the time, which is what many other people don't have to deal with in their work. Right, where it's like,
oh, that's a really good point.
Themselves all the time. I think that's why a lot of people go, oh, I could never do that, because it really is the examined self and presenting themselves and, you know, turning inside out on a regular basis, even if you have rehearsed it a million times, like, oh, yeah. Like, you're putting it into this place where it's like, this is a story of myself that I can tell, so it's separated from myself, but there are still tethers, like, there's still an umbilical cord feeding that. And, like, when that thing is rejected, that's why all the feedback comes through that cord and it hits you in your soul, because it was your soul that you put out there, even if you did it in this very sort of, you know, dead butterfly pressed sort of form.
Yeah.
You know, it's still connected to a life force that is you and that you have to live with. So, yeah, I don't know. It is important to manage that. Like, we do take for granted, and because we have this comedy protective shell of defense that we've learned for whatever reasons to have and then to manipulate for the benefit of others, you know, but it's still connected to something that's still alive, even if it's like buried. So,
Yes, you, well, that's the second time you've kind of made reference to a kind of a protective thing. You said before that it was kind of talking and talking fast as a survival skill.
Yeah.
What sorts of things were you surviving?
Oh, God, yeah, I know. I made it sound like I was growing up in a war-torn.
No, not at all.
No.
There's all sorts of things you could have been surviving.
Yeah, no, I think that so let's see, I'm like, where to begin? Because I feel like it's the things that, like, you talk about all the time, but, like, I would love to be able to present that sort of honestly and directly in this time. This moment. But I think so, for me, where do I start? So I'm a kid three of four, you know, middle child, which I think middle children.
Oh, yeah,
have
if
that.
You're three of four, you've even got to fight to be the middle.
Yeah, right.
You're one of two middles.
Exactly. Yeah, okay. Exactly. And I was, you know, very studious child. I was always a fat kid, which is like a fat kids are funny because that's the way people don't tell you to, like, go away and die, you fat fuck. You know what I mean? Like, that's just what you get. And you get it from your family before you even go to school. Okay. Do you know what I mean? Like, your family is the one that's like, we got to fix you. What's wrong with you? Like, you know, like, first of all, you have too many feelings. Why do you have so many feelings? That's ridiculous. Oh, you're sensitive? Hee ha ha. So it's like, well, I can't share that with them. Why don't I just eat them? You know? So then that's a coping skill. And then they're like, why are you doing that? Like, oh God, this is like, it's
there's a lot to unpack.
Sure.
So you're talking about your feelings as a kid, pre kind of fat being an issue. You mean it's you've got a lot of feelings and that became the issue of fatness. Is that what you mean?
Yes. And at the same time, like, I came out a fat baby and then I didn't stop. Right. So, like, I'm gold star fatty. Now, I think that from the time that I can remember, like I had glasses since the time I was three. I had a, you know, cross-eyed with an astigmatism, right? You know, overweight kid, and was just sort of quiet and also, like, desperately wanted connection, engagement, which was not forthcoming. You know, I'm sort of that sort of end of Gen X kind of latchkey kid. You know, I was the one who watched my little brother coming home from school because my older sister and a brother, or my older half sister and brother, there's like a 9 and 13 year difference between me and them. So they were already like teenage to grown.
You had to do all the responsibilities of being the oldest kid without even being the oldest kid.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. You know, because when you're in the middle, everyone just expects you to be raised by the ones around you. So they're just like, whatever, you're fine. we already did that. Figure it out. Here's a key. You know where you live. Or if you don't, figure it out. So there is just sort of, there's that put on your shoulders of like, sort it out in terms of the practicalities of life as well as the sort of emotional life. And, you know, I don't know, I presume, being myself, that everybody needs that kind of engagement when they're young, but maybe not everyone does. I did. Mm-hmm. And that was not something that was forthcoming because I, you know, whatever. Our parents did what they had to do to, like, all go out to jobs that were terrible and too far away and, like, took too much of their time and their energy to, like, put a roof over our heads and all of that good stuff, which, as an adult, I understand the sacrifices they made. I really appreciate that. I wouldn't be in the positions that I have been throughout my life had they not done that. However, at the same time, certain things were lacking, right? And so, you know, I was left to come home after school, feed myself from whatever was bought at a Costco, you know, from the fridge, and then just and get my homework done. So it's like, basically, I was good at being studious. So I just went really hard at, like, I get attention and acceptance for being smart. And I am smart. It's something that I can do. I can do well. And I like being in class and raising my hand and having a teacher give me a gold star and all of that stuff. It is the one place where I feel like recognized, alive, like I excel, like I belong. Right. So I'm going to do that.
And was the lack of recognition at home more to do with your parents not physically being there because they were working? Or was it more to do with you feeling like they didn't recognize, they didn't appreciate you?
Yes. Yeah. All yeah. of the above. I mean, they were not around because they were working. You know, I mean, my mother commuted 4 hours every day, like two in and two back into Los Angeles from the suburbs where we lived, because that's traffic in LA. And, you know, and I mean, I specifically remember, this is like a therapist couch thing of being, like, you know, I'm like, I was probably like 12, like 11 or 12. And I was like, I need you to talk to me sometimes. You know, my mom being like, when I get home from work, I'm tired. I don't want to talk to you, you know? Oh, right. And man. Like, that's the thing that a mom's going to, I mean, especially mothers of color, they're just like, my life's hard. Like, I'm working. I love you because you live in a house. Mm-hmm. You know, like, you're not on the street, whatever, the way that my love language is providing for you. And I get and appreciate that. Mine was having some kind of emotional engagement, and there was no one in my family that spoke that language, right? Yeah. So yeah. I had to kind of wait for a while to figure out if there were people in the world who did and how I could go about finding those people and connecting to those people. So I think that was sort of the main, like, whatever psychic emotional breach sure. in my youth that I had constantly tried to sort of navigate, you know, bridge, overcome in some way. And I mean, I remember being in kindergarten. And, you know, we were all fenced in. There was, like, you know, the, like, little kindergarten prison. And, like, you know, first, second, third grade was all around. And I remember being at the fence. I don't know what I was doing. I was, like, making faces or doing some dance or whatever. And I remember, like, traditional, like, snot-nosed, white kid, crew-cut, Kool-Aid ring around his mouth, bully kid, being like, oh, she's funny. Look at her. She's funny. And, like, it literally clicked inside my head. And I was like, they're pointing at me, and they're saying she's funny, and not look at this fat kid. And yeah. I was just like, boom. Like, instantaneously, like, that is when it happened.
Do you think bullies, kids who are bullies, get up in the morning and go, I'm gonna go and create some comedians?
I'm a kingmaker. Yeah. Come to school in their limo.
Get back in touch with you 30 years later. I think I need 10%.
Exactly.
I
think you'll find I did that. I'm like, why do you still have a Kool-Aid ring around your mouth, man? Like, we're grown. No, I think they go, like, I don't know, my dad kicked the shit out of me all weekend. Let me sure. go. But yes, I'd love it if they were just out there here to, you know, produce, be agents, producers, and other facilitators. You know, they're the, you know, they're the inspirational teacher from all of those, like, early 90s movies.
But you didn't go off the rails and become focused on being the class clown because you were studious and you enjoyed yeah. working. So that's quite a good combo, right?
Yeah.
Of, like, you can be the funny and bright kid.
Yeah, I was like, I loved authority. I love people telling me what to do. How great is that? I wish I had somebody now to just tell me what the fuck to do. You know, yeah. don't you hasn't told me, like, can someone just come in here and say, stop doing that, start doing that, do it by midnight, I'll come back and check your work. And I'd be like, thank you so much.
Yes. And of course, that's the one thing that in comedy is never going to happen.
Yeah.
So this is Desiree, just a joy to speak to. As I mentioned before, there's over 30 minutes of extras available to you if you're in the Insiders Club, including her very inspiring thoughts on being her own boss and recognising her own value. And we go really deeply into her last show, Desiree's Coming Early, which used a sort of twin, a dual narrative to reframe her own personal history whilst being very, very funny indeed. So all of that available to you if you're a member of the Insiders Club, comedianscomedian.com/insiders. And if you are currently salaried or not struggling like a self-employed person at the moment, then consider donating some of your toilet paper and shotgun money to joining the Insiders Club at whatever level you see fit, safe in the knowledge that it's very easy to downgrade that level once everything's calm and live comedy starts happening again. So that's all of that. I've got no live work to tell you about. Let's gloss over that. But here's something I can tell you about. Like every comedian in the world, over the last week, I have been scrabbling in what I'm sure will be referred to in years to come as the Great Pivot, to create more online work. So one of the things I'm doing, as well as a number of special episodes coming your way soon with comedians who are being particularly agile during the Great Pivot, and I'm going to talk to a lot of comics and also do some special mini episodes with people in the comedy world at large about how they're reacting to the crisis. I want to know how you're doing. I want to know whether you're bunkered up. I hope you're all being socially distanced, socially responsible, if not actively on lockdown. So get in touch, info@comedianscomedian.com, and tell me your stories of how you're coping, how you are managing your mental health, how you are using creativity, perhaps, whatever you're into, to keep yourself sane under these circumstances. So we'll keep it com-com themed under the broad umbrella of the remit of this show. How are you surviving this? I'm not going to call it an apocalypse, but it's not great, is it? So the other thing I was going to mention was you can join me for a working lunch. Go to comedianscomedian.com/lunch and you can book yourself a one-to-one social or professional online lunch date with me. You bring your own lunch and your own Wi-Fi and your own laptop, and we connect remotely whilst socially isolating. And I'm very happy to have a social natter with you, or for a longer period and a different price. You and I can have not just a kind of, you know, interaction, but we can actually brainstorm whatever creative project you're interested in. I think those are going to be a lot of fun. I've already booked a few of those, so thank you very much to everyone that's got on with those. And if you haven't already downloaded and listened to it, there is a special episode preceding this one, which is about resilience and creativity at times of crisis. I've tried to use some of the learning from the last 330 episodes to share with you my ideas. I mean, I mostly recorded it for me to help me stay sane, but I think it's of value. It might cheer you up or reassure you somehow. And to look into what some of the things I've learned from doing the podcast can help me and maybe help you cope with the demands of the age. I mean, we just kind of come up with more and more ways of not saying fucking great big terrifying pandemic. But there we go. comedianscomedian.com/lunch to book that. That's all for now. Let's get back to Desiree Birch.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I wonder, in that kind of the sort of the creation of a Desiree Birch as a child, one of the things is the desire for kind of appreciation.
Yeah.
And one of the things, and I know some of your work and in interviews I've read with you has been about the concept of being a black person in predominantly white spaces.
Yeah.
Is there a connection between that and this sort of sense of permission?
Probably. Oh my God, free therapy, Stu. Thank you. I mean, probably. I think that I've always existed in that fish out of water space, which is probably lends itself to comedy quite well.
100%.
But, you know, my parents moved out of sort of South Central Los Angeles when I was 6 months old because it was dangerous. Yeah. And they could move way out to the suburbs in a place that wasn't even a town yet, mm-hmm. where they could buy a house for not that much money. And then, mm-hmm. you know, these days, 40 years later, like those homes are selling for $1 million, you know, but like at the time it was the sticks. So they just moved out there. So it, you know, immediately predominantly white, and actually East Asian, surroundings where it was like, okay, we were sort of at some time the only ones. And then there are a few more, but like, there is that isolation and that feeling of like, okay, I don't belong here, but if I do really well, because that's sort of the old concept, that's that sort of Bill Cosby respectability politics, you know.
Yeah, sure,
I mean,
sure.
there is an era of like I mean, it predates him. It's just like he's famous for, you know, purporting that, but the like be really good and be exceptional. There's like the whole like be the best and you have to be twice as good kind of mentality, but there's also the like be respectable and then you'll be accepted and then you won't have problems. Mm-hmm. But that is literally being accepted by predominantly white notion of what is acceptable.
Totally.
And then once you get that, you become sort of excised from your group.
Yes.
Which is already like not exactly what I wanted because I wanted to belong. So
totally.
It's like,
it's a funny sort of a victory, isn't it?
Yes.
To like, oh, what, I've won now, have I? I've been accepted by people who I'm not like by pretending to be like them in ways that aren't important to
yes.
me.
Yes, and I'll never be like them, and I also won't be like what I am. So I'll always be this sort of singular, isolated thing.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, it is that thing of like, I mean, I guess it's a good thing that I haven't had like a traumatic brain injury because like that's two seconds away from like sociopath, psychopath, you know, like all you need is someone who's kind of like, okay, like I don't belong and I'm constantly putting on a performance for everybody, you know, in order to be, and then like to get hit by a car and then sure. you're just murdering people. From what we've all learned from watching too many crime documentaries. So I think, you know, there was that upbringing. There was me being like, at some point, and also, growing up in Los Angeles, like everything around it is the backlot of Hollywood in terms of everybody works in the industry, desperately wants to work in the industry, or just wants to look like they belong in the industry. So just growing up and being like, I don't look like anything that, you know, LA is supposed to look like. I'm not thin. I'm not blonde. I'm not white. I'm not like, oh my God. I like have thoughts. And if I express them, people go like, why? And so like, I was like, at some point I knew from early on, probably in my tween years of being like, I gotta get the fuck out of here. And so when it came time to go to schools, I was like, okay, I'm going to apply to UCLA because it's the best school near me. But I'm also going to apply to Harvard, Yale, and NYU because they are on the other side of the world, and I have to believe that they're, to me, on the other mm. side of the world, I have to believe that not everyone is like this anywhere else in the world, right? And because the feedback loop of all of the media that you're getting comes from the same place that you live, and you're just like, is this the whole universe? Because, like, I don't think it can be, because if so, I don't belong in the universe.
Yes.
And that probably isn't right, but maybe it is. So I was just like, okay, let me go to the school on the other side of the country. So then, you know, I got into Yale, went to Yale, was like, okay, great. But then, again, you're a fish out of water in a different kind of place where culturally you're just like, all of these kids went to private school since the day they were, you know, like I am way out of my depth. And at the time, you don't realize that everybody else your age feels like they're way out of their depth as
sure.
well.
Yeah.
But like there's the academic sort of out of your depth. And then there's the cultural, like, I don't even know, like these people have the kinds of names I've only seen on buildings, you know, or heard in pop. Like, I don't understand what that's like. I'm like, you're a Rothschild? Like, what the fuck? You know, so like I didn't even understand that concept of like old money in the way like America yes. has old money, even though it's yes. all relatively none of it's that old. But like, you know, that sort of idea of what do your family do kind of thing until I got there. And that was a complete mind fuck for 4 years, you know, as well as the sort of academic rigor and whatnot, you know. And you do find friends and people that, you know, I'm still friends with to this day that I love and adore. But at the same time, you're just like, I don't like all, everybody is amazing. And also everybody comes from this culture that like, I just don't belong to. So there's that. And so I think that I've always kind of maintained that relationship to things, because then I just was like, okay, we'll go to New York City because that'll be hard. And I'm used to doing hard things that I don't know how to do and trying to excel at them. And that's like a goal or a benchmark I can set for myself to try to achieve.
Yes.
But that's where the control freak that comes in. It's like, oh, well, if I can do this, then I have another thing under control. And then if I can do that, and that becomes its own monster as well.
Yes. Yes. And I suppose if there is... Is there one of the attractive things about comedy is that it's incredibly difficult, and so there's always an opportunity. There's kind of inbuilt drama and heroism in trying to do something incredibly hard, and even if you fail, you were trying to do something incredibly hard
that, like, you know, 90%+ of the population cannot do or would not even try to make themselves do, where it's like, oh my god, you only got a bronze medal in the Olympics, like, you know, like, seriously. Yeah, sure. That's, you know, well beyond what anybody else is thinking about. So putting yourself in those positions, as you say, of being like, okay, we're in this exceptional class of doing something very difficult, there's still glory and mystique around
one of the things about comedy that this podcast I now realize in retrospect was an attempt to get over the fact that to me comedy felt like having homework for the rest of my life.
Yes.
Because you could always be writing.
Yeah.
Well, I wonder if as well, for someone who's a sort of high academic achiever like yourself, whether it's like having an exam for the rest of your life. Get examined every day, every gig. You've got to get that gold star.
Yes.
And so you can pit yourself against it, and it will presumably, sometimes it will reward you and you will get the gold star. And sometimes the experience of not is its reward isn't the right word, but it's satisfying somehow because it means you still took the exam every night.
Yeah. Gosh, you're brilliant. But you really are. But yeah, I think that there is the sort of, there's the exam, or like, I'm in this really important program at school. And like, even if I didn't do the top in my class, but you always want to be the top in your class, like that night on the show. Like, I don't know if everybody, I try to now remind myself, like, you got to be the best you, not the best on the show. Because in my mind, it was always like, I got to be better than everyone else. And that's that overachiever, straight A, grade grubber thing.
Does that benefit you, though? Because I speak to a lot of people. I don't really have that kind of killer instinct of like, I have to be the best on the show.
Which is good, I think.
Well, I think I'm maybe, I was going to say maybe I'm happier. I'm sort of maybe less happy, but for different reasons. But, but I feel like increasingly you're on a hiding to nothing if you're just always trying to win. But then part of the, like, why don't you always try and win? I think to myself, yeah, but why don't you have that killer instinct for 20 years and then look back and you can comfortably regret that once you're at the top of the pile? Do you know what I mean? Because it does get you places, right? Wanting to win gets you places.
Wanting to win, again, but it is the escape velocity thing. Like, wanting to win does get you places, but at some point it's like, I mean, I'm sure you guys had TV shows like this, you know, like we had this TV show in like the 80s, 90s called Head of the Class. And it was like, you know, this teacher, and it was like only the smart kids in the school, kind of thing, you know. And so it's, the thing is, it's like in that class, there is no point in being the best in that class, because at some point somebody's got to be the physics nerd and somebody's got to be the classics nerd and somebody's got to be, you know, the person that like connects those two, and someone's got to be the ones like, I'm flipping my pencil all the time, I don't really care, but when I show up to mathletes, like, I totally throw down. And like, you know, at some point it's like, yeah, you do have to be the best, and I have that killer instinct, but then also sometimes the killer instinct, like the best application of it, is like, oh, I have to be the best me I can be, because at some point being really good at killing keeps you like really good at doing clubs on the road. But in order to get your show or your thing, you've got to be so crystalline, specifically you, that you are irreplaceable, and that we have to have your story and your thing. And that's not to say that you can't have the killer instinct and, you know, be yourself. But there are times when you have to kind of find nuance and not, you know, that there's that thing in comedy where, I'm sure we all have. You found yourself on stage saying something that you're like, why is this coming out of my mouth? Like, I don't believe this, but I know that this audience is going to laugh at it. So I'm going to tell them what they want and not what I wanted to say. And there's always this balance between, I got to give you what you want, because that's my job. Like, I'm here because you're drunk and I gotta keep you from fucking and fighting in the middle of the room. And this is the way that I do that. And then I get paid for doing that, right? But like, you know, but I also need to get something out of this, because otherwise I'm just like dredging up my life stories for no discernibly good reason to entertain drunkards and to go home alone and empty, like sad clown crying into an empty bottle, right?
Yep.
So it has to be enough of both. And if you're doing that killer thing, it's like, this is for you and I'm gonna make you do this. And like, you know, like it's like the person in sex who never lets you go down on them, you know, where it's like, I want to be the one pleasing you. I get off on you getting off, but yeah, they never open themselves up to receive anything. And sure, so you kind of feel like, are you there? Or like, you know, like I want to connect to you, but so anyway, I say that lots of analogies just to say that I do think it requires, or at least for me, I'm trying to look for the other side of that a little bit, yes, more, because I have focused on pleasing others more than I have being like presenting myself.
Yes. Now, you seem, a couple of things you've said have made me think you use the phrase despair and compare and despair. That makes me, that feels like therapy language.
It is.
And you feel quite reconstructed the way you're talking about it. Like,
yeah,
you feel like, yeah, I went through a thing and now I can see that and yeah, I'm aware and I'm trying to change that. Is that kind of, is that fair? Is that,
yeah,
fair observation?
I think that's fair. I mean, I have not done as much therapy as I would like to or need, but I've done enough and I've, you know, you've come across people, like, you know, every person is a gift of their lived experience and information. I think compare and despair comes from like AA or something. I think that's,
sure, okay,
somebody told me that or whatever, and I was like, oh, that's beautiful, like, yeah, that's exactly what we do.
Yep.
And so, but and especially after having been in New York for 13 years, I was like, that's all any of us are doing all the time, is looking at what we don't have or what we feel like we should or what the next thing is. And so, yeah, I mean, I am, I don't, is there anyone who isn't reconstructed? Or especially in comedy, I think if you do it long enough and you don't wind up killing yourself through drink or drugs or extreme lengths of poverty or whatever else to do what you do, you have to do that. You know, like there's only so much you can dredge yourself up and sort of look at yourself before you're compelled to examine yourself in order to get like good. And usually that is assisted by the outside help of therapy and not just telling people in an audience and then never dealing with it at all. But yeah, I think that different elements in my life have kind of helped me to at least start to recognize what is there and what I'm dealing with, as well as just me being a thoughtful person who, you know, we all write at some point, however we write. If you do enough writing, you know, it is a mirror for your mind. And at some point you start looking at what is going on. And if you were a thoughtful
person, put, yeah,
it is,
yeah,
you know, absolutely. And as a thoughtful person, you know, you're kind of like, oh, well, I can examine. Now I'm reading a book. I'm reading a story of someone, because we all live ourselves, you know, as stories to a certain extent. Like we all have these egos that are in this narrative that we consider to be our life story. And at some point, if you're fortunate enough, you realize that there is something underneath that that is actually you, that doesn't have to be beholden to any one story, even though we kind of swing vine to vine from different ones, you know, because that's the way our brains work, like that you can kind of,
you can decide on a self-image, and yeah, then later you can, if yeah, you're clever, I don't know, not if you're clever enough, if you just notice,
yeah,
if you notice that you've done that, or someone points out that you've done that, or you learn it somehow, you go, oh, I have a story, yeah, that I'm telling myself, that's,
yes,
me, and I can, if I want to, I can put,
yes,
that down
I
and make a choice.
I can close the book on that story, yeah, like if I want to, I can be like, that story's done, or I like that character, let's read the next novel where they do other things.
Yeah, oh my God, that is such a good, I hope people listening to this, and I hope I can engage with this as well, but I hope people listening to this can get that, that is a big thing to know.
Yeah.
That's so important,
yeah,
to know. And it makes me think of the what we were talking about earlier on about permission and being in spaces that don't necessarily have people like you, even recognizing that you need to get out of where you're living.
Yeah.
The value of actually realizing that, because think of the people who never realize that.
Yeah.
People, whether they're in relationships that are toxic or just unhelpful.
Yeah.
Or people who are in jobs or social situations or geographical locations which are no good, who simply never had the notion. I don't mean they weren't smart enough.
No.
I just mean it just never occurred
to them that
leaving, just
leaving.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just that. Well, there are the people who say, you know, I had an ex who would say things like, well, what choice did I have? And like, there are those of us who say, you always have a choice, right?
Mm.
And so, I mean, it is about the perspective shift of being like, I can just say no, because, you know, the like, literally the character of Desiree that everyone knows and that I know, like, is like, that's a character, but that's not a human being. Like, a human being is unknowable, whether that's a partner or whether that's yourself. Like, you don't, you like, knowing yourself is a journey. Like, you don't ever really complete it, right? You know, because you've not been in every single situation, and until you've been in every single situation, how do you know who the hell you are, right? Because you know, we've all done things that have surprised ourselves. Right. And it's like, and it's not because like, oh, that's what a Desiree or a Stu would do. It was, you know, it's like the, you know, the stranger, you know, Camus is just like, you know, he's like, I don't know why I shot the guy. The sun was in my eye. Do you know what I mean?
I actually don't know much Camus.
Okay. Gotcha. So, I mean, sorry to ruin it, but
no, not at all.
No, I mean, it's not like a ruin it,
spoiler alert.
But it's a very existentialist novel. But like the guy who's like being on trial for the murder, but he does say this thing of like, you know, essentially the sun was in my eye and I pulled the trigger. Right. Because we like to think that things happen for a reason, and they usually happen for a multiplicity of reasons, and also because phenomena and circumstance and like the, I don't know, the sun, I turned left.
Yeah.
And then the rest of my life happened because I turned left. Like, you know, there are lots of reasons the thing happens, and then sometimes just things happen. But I think some of us are beholden to the reasons and the narrative and like, well, what choice did I have? And it's like any number of them. Like, it's probably a multiverse. Any number of choices if you actually took the time to go, like, do I want to be in this position? Is this bringing me joy or pain? Is this the reason that I'm alive or not? Right. And I think some of us go like, okay, well, let me remove myself from that and do something else, or at least plant that seed in my mind so that in a month, a year, however much time, I might be in a different place. Or people who are just kind of like, this is my lot in life. And they're like tearing at their clothes and they're like, this is who I am. And it's like, great.
I've definitely been both of those people. I've definitely done things where I'm like, this is not the right thing for me to do, really. But I can't admit that to myself because I'm too busy fulfilling the narrative that I've decided in.
Yes.
You know, I'm this person, and this person doesn't quit when he discovers he's in the wrong thing.
Yes.
No, the person that I am sees it through badly in the wrong way for years.
Which is, I mean, it's great to be able to be an artist in that regard, to be a comedian or to be a clown or an actor, because you recognize character, you recognize the mask, you recognize like, these are the choices that this person would make, and so that is why I'm making these choices, because that is what Stu would do on this day, obviously. You know? But it's amazing to be the person that recognizes that thing even while you're doing it. Like, we've all been in the middle of doing something being like, I guess this is what I go and do now, right? This is right. And everyone's like, yeah, that's right. And you're like, okay.
Let's talk about Desiree is Coming Early.
Yeah.
Which I saw at Edinburgh last year.
Thank you so much for coming.
In the Hive.
Early. Yes.
And I did come early. I did. It was quite early on in the run.
Oh, sweet. Thank you. That's when I need friends the most.
Hey, no worries. It was an extraordinary show.
Thank you.
I had seen clips of yours before, and I, as we see in the clips of you that are available online, it's really kind of empowered, sort of positive, kind of scathing, but in a warm kind of way.
Yeah.
You've got lots of stuff on sex and really being the master of your own destiny.
Yeah.
You know, some stuff about dating, when it's really from a very well-observed, well-written, but really flowing, conversational kind of a way. And then, so all of that, Desiree, I feel like I knew a little bit of.
Yeah.
And of course, the other element in the picture of you in my mind before I saw that show was that I know that you have a kind of, almost like, what's the word? Not quite an offbeat sensibility, or a kind of an outsider sensibility.
Yeah.
Like your poster with the penises, the penis poster. So let's just
still
tell us.
Still a classic one.
I mean, it's hard for me to explain really what that was. So why don't you tell us what that was?
This. So, The first stand-up hour, like completely the stand-up hour that I took to Edinburgh in 2006.
And was that your first stand-up hour?
Yeah.
Or was that just your first one at Edinburgh?
That was my first hour. Like, I came from basically solo performance. Like, I'd done a lot of theater in New York. I came from one-woman shows.
Gotcha.
So the first time I went to Edinburgh, I took the show called 52 Man Pickup, which was all about everyone I'd ever had sex with on a deck of cards. And it
Fantastic.
Was, like, shuffled, random, interactive, but it was very much, like...
Great. strong theatrical format there.
Right, exactly, yeah, yeah, right? Yeah. So it was very much theater, like the trappings of theater and experimental devised theater.
Okay, but not
so
funny.
But what's funny? Okay. Yeah, definitely. But it was the kind of show that, you know, it's like, well, it doesn't, like, people are like, well, it's not stand-up, even though it's like comedy and the jokes are funny and it's like stand-up jokes in these storytelling narratives. It's storytelling, really. And it's like, it's not quite theater because it's too stand-up-y, and it's not quite stand-up because it's too theater-y. And so I've often sort of suffered from being in the middle of two different places, but that's kind of where interesting things happen, which is why I like to do that. So that was the first time I'd ever brought a thing to Edinburgh. But the first time I was like, this is a stand-up show with me at a microphone telling jokes like stand-up, mm-hmm. was called This Is Evolution. And I did that in 2016. Yes. And so the poster for it was a picture of me, just like a photo I had taken. But the picture comprised like dick pics. So I basically am the kind of weirdo that if you're a dude who sent me your dick, I was like, well, it's mine now. I'm like the mom who's like, your ball's in my yard. It's mine now.
They were
it's
your
mine.
Dick pics. They belonged to you.
That dude sent it out into the universe, not giving a shit what happened to it. He sent it to me. It's mine now.
Well, no, I just from the point of, and let's just explain. It's literally your face is made up out of dicks.
Yeah, so it's all these dicks repositioned, colorized, repurposed, flipped around, whatever, to like basically as a painting make up my face.
And you could walk past it and go, oh, there's an interesting mottled effect on that picture.
Yes.
What the fuck?
Yes.
Like, that was the...
So I stay with my friends when I do Edinburgh, and they're a couple. They have two kids. And so she looked at the photo, the poster, and she was like, she's like, oh, it's interesting. She's like, it's kind of weird. She's like, it's kind of like scary, actually. And then he walked in the kitchen. He's like, ha, bunch of knobs. Yeah. And then walked out. Right? So like literally some people saw it right away. Some people were like, I walked by it all summer and I never saw it until somebody said it's a bunch of dicks. And then they're like, what? So it's, I don't know if it's like a magic eye poster or whatever. But like, yeah, you could walk by and be like, oh, it's kind of a painting or just a bunch of knobs.
And I mean, I enjoyed it for its own sake. But also finding out that the knobs in that picture are knobs that were sent to you. That gives it another kind of magical quality somehow. That's,
yes.
It reminds me of the... there was a guy I went to... I did a devised theatre degree, and there was a guy on my course who... he made a bull roarer, you know, one of those Aboriginal Australian... like a piece of wood with wire, and you wind it to open dimensional gateways or something.
Wow.
But he made one of those out of a floorboard from the house he was born in. It's one of those, you know what I mean? It's like, take the thing, transform the thing.
Yeah.
It has its... it kind of carries with it the magical power.
The so magical power, yeah.
These were magic dicks that had been sent.
Like, magic eye dicks.
You made the dicks magic because they were just dicks
on
the
just
internet.
They were just regular old not magic dicks.
but ones that had been sent to you, so you reappropriated the dicks.
Yes. Although, to be fair, at some point I ran out of the utility of all the dicks that I had sent, and so I had to get a gay friend of mine to add a couple of dicks in there.
Okay.
So there's many of a repeated dick. You'll be like, that's the same dick, inner eyebrow and inner lip.
Sure,
but at some point I was like, we need some differently shaped dicks to make some of these...
Very sensible.
But they were all unsolicited dicks.
Yes,
that is
for
certain.
That's part of the magic element.
And part of the reason I did that is just because when I lived in New York, like, I mean, it happens anywhere, right? You know how people just draw dicks on things.
Sure.
And like, especially, you know, the subway posters in New York City immediately get a dick on it. Like, you see them and you're like, why does anyone take a picture of a woman with her mouth slightly ajar or her butt in the picture? Because it's just asking for a dick to be on it. And so I was just like, I want to be famous enough that I have my poster up there and that someone draws a dick on it.
Okay.
And then I was like, actually, you know what? I'm just going to claim that now. I'm just going to put dicks all over my poster, and then nobody else, if they do it, it's just like putting a hat on a hat.
And that was your that was your debut show at Edinburgh.
Yes.
So that is an extraordinary, if you'll forgive the expression, ballsy move. Do you know what I mean? That's the sort of thing you could imagine an agent forbidding their client from doing.
Yes.
Right? Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
That's like,
that was before I had an agent.
Oh, you're
so
really
going to
do that?
Yes.
Because not only is it a photo with multiple penises on it, it's your face.
Yeah.
And that is, like, it's one of those things where, what's the phrase? It is a high-risk strategy, right?
Yeah.
Because, I don't quite know what I mean by the risk, but it's, you know what I mean? It's
yes,
like, you
of
should
course.
Never do that.
Do that.
And the fact that you did that was why it was so striking and extraordinary, and it made everyone go, what?
Yeah. But I mean, that's also Edinburgh. Edinburgh is the place of like high risk strategies, right?
Well, because it should be.
Well, yes, it is diminishing in that regard these days. But like at that time, I was like, The year before, I had taken a theater piece that I brought over from New York, and I did the theater version of the festival, which is a totally different festival, right?
Talk to me about that. I've never done the theater version.
I mean, it's not entirely different, but it's just different people, different timing. So I brought this show called Tar Baby. It was all about race and capitalism in America. It's very, you know, 90-minute, one-woman show, like a big prop box, costumes, you know, doing this whole aesthetic of, like, being a carnival barker, you know, selling the ideas of certain sort of tropes, stereotypes, and whatever, because I'm talking about how sort of race is propagandized.
And at that time, you were already a comic. So you were a stand-up,
yes.
But you had chosen to do not a stand-up show, but a one-woman show.
Yeah, this was the last show that I had been doing in New York before I moved over. And, you know, and it was something that continues to be important to me. And I was like, let me take this to Edinburgh. I had gone with 52, which had been in the comedy category. Mm-hmm. And I was like, this is theater. I'm not going to make anybody come expecting to see a comedy show, lock the doors and being like, 90 minutes of race. Right? It is theater, sure. Right? And so... you know, so then, like, my show was on at noon in the turret at Gilded Balloon, you know, like, during the daytime, you get, like, and it was that kind of thing where it's, like, it got a Fringe first, and then, you know, like, you get, like, an award, and then you get, like, the Guardian review, and the next day, there's, like, 50 people who are over 70 sitting, and you're, like, oh, shit. Yeah. Here we go. Mm-hmm. You know, before it's like, you know, very diverse crowd, whatever. Then as soon as it pops, like, it's just full up with like people who are like, we hear this is important.
Because all the silver tops like to buy tickets in advance as
yes.
well. So
they're like, here's my ticket in advance. And they're like, we've read, we should see this.
That's
and
it's your
like,
run knacker.
That's good. But it's also kind of like, I don't know if you're necessarily the people who are going to bet. You're the people who are going to come, not always, but frequently with the strongest resistance to these ideas. So anyway, like just the whole world of like, oh, the awards for that and the reviewers and the how to, you know, and I had gone a couple times before. So it's like I had friends there. Like I had a friend who's a photographer who lives there. And she's like, oh, well, because I'm a photographer, I know certain people at mm-hmm. certain newspapers and I can help you reach out to them. Like it was really grassroots of like just trying to get anyone to care mm-hmm. about this theater piece. But like, you know, I had to wake up at 8 a.m. and make sure I'd like ironed out costumes and whatever. Like it's not a thing that you're doing, you know, and I wasn't I did some comedy gigs while I was there only to promote the show,
okay.
you know, to confuse people once they came to see this show. Still a very funny show because like humor is in all the things I do, but not stand up. Didn't really drink because I had to keep a voice so I could do a show for 90 minutes every mm-hmm. morning and like was trying to go to bed at like, you know, 8, 9, 10 o'clock every night. Like it was just a different, it was like when I started to really discover how much work the Fringe is, you know, talking about exams, like that's the big sort of exam. Like we all get to, you know, May, June, July, like we've been revising for an exam forever. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, you're in July and you're like, it's coming and I'm not ready and I'm not going to pass out of school. And like my life's going to explode. I'm never going to be anything if this show doesn't go well and get like everyone to love it, which like we all have these ridiculous fantasies, but like that's the sort of big crunch time exam. So that, in some ways it was really hard work, but it was also really wonderful to just be like, I know these comics and I like kind of see them in passing, but I'm not hanging out at, you know, the Loft or Brooks Bar. I'm not doing any of that festival at all.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like I'm like trying to go on a healthy walk and like talking, seeing other people's theater shows and like doing that whole thing. So that had been the year before. And this was like, okay, I need to like, that had gone really well, but I do need to distinguish myself as a comedian because this is how I'm going to live and make money in this country, and I need to like be like, here's my comedy, here is who, you know. And I think that your first show is frequently like a greatest hits catalog of the mm-hmm. jokes that you've been telling up to the point at which you can actually have a show to be like, this is who the hell I am. And then your freshman show goes well, and then you're like, ah, hell, like I you know, because sophomore year is always pretty rough. You're like the second tricky second, right? You know, mm-hmm. you've got to go do that. But like, so that first one was like, I gotta go balls out, dick pics, and like here's all my comedy, like, you know, this is who I am. And then that's started people being like, oh, okay, you're Yeah, you're a comic. Come and, you know, do these gigs. Come, yeah, there's a Soho run, like all of that stuff. And I was like, okay, great. Like, I can actually make a job of this now.
And so what kind of things were similar and what kind of things were different in your construction of the two shows? The 90-minute show about race, mm-hmm. and which doesn't have to be funny, bits of it are funny, but mm-hmm. like in terms of the making, the writing, the direction, are you kind of self-directing because you're devising?
Oh, God, no. I come from theater well enough to know, get yourself a fucking director.
Okay. Like,
I
mean, for stand-up as well?
Yeah, okay. I do. Because I, in terms of the similarities between them, I like to construct stand-up hours with a narrative. So I'm still a solo performer at heart. I mean, a lot of us do. And I think that's partially why I do love comedy in the UK, because a lot of it is based on, you know, the Edinburgh Hour, doing an hour of stand-up, having a narrative arc, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So in terms of similarity, I do like to have something that I know has kind of a narrative arc and also has, like, meaning. Like, I care, like, I want to impart something that I think is important to impart to people, you know, like, a lot of comics are like, I just want to make people laugh, you know, and whatever I do that and, like, make them have a good time. And people who do that really well are beautiful because they're just, you know, masters of, like, fuckery and upending mm-hmm. things. And it's great to watch that, you know, and anything less than that, it's just like, oh, great. We've got a joke about the, you know, dentist. Like, why? Why is anyone alive to hear this? You know, so I feel like there's got to be something that, you know, again, that sort of give and take, that, like, I want to give you laughter and also give you a part of myself and something that I feel like is important to me, even if it's my perspective on the world. And, you know, a lot of my stuff is like, you know, I like to be like, ah, it's just dick ass and pussy jokes, you know, and mm-hmm. that's just me sort of, you know, undercutting my work. But, like, you know, a lot of it is very sort of like body, physical, sex, relationships, because, I mean, that is in part like the basis of humanity. A lot of that is my story as a woman in a certain kind of body that is, you know, racialized, you know, like has a different size, is sexualized differently, and is a perspective that maybe not a lot of people have, but people see the other side of. And for the people who do come from that perspective, they feel like, oh, I get to be seen through this person who's talking about it, because not enough people talk about it. Like, I can't tell you the amount of television, film, other media that I grew up on that I just looked at not belonging in anywhere, yeah. and just being like, why is this important? It's like, and I have to care about your story all the time. And that's great. And I feel like I know your story really well, mm-hmm. you know, and I also feel like I have a responsibility to myself to be like, well, here's mine, and actually grow into the feeling that it deserves some kind of a recognition or a telling or a whatever. So I think that putting myself on the line is important, because people feel that inherently, and it raises the stakes of what you're doing, yep. and it raises the immediacy and the connectability of what you're doing, because the more specific you are to yourself, the more universal those things become, and people kind of feel and recognize that in your work, and they're like, wow, even though, you know, it can come off on the surface as like, you're just telling dick jokes, it's like, but, like, really you're talking about, like, you know, humanity or, you know, discrimination or power or these other things underlying that stuff, and I feel that.
Which way round do those things come? Do you have an idea for a dick joke and then realize it's about power, or do you have an idea for a power joke and hide it in a dick joke?
I wish that I was clever enough to do the latter. I think that my mind immediately goes to filth, and then I go, like, where does that come from, or what is that related to? And then I'm like, oh, actually, you know, and then you start building on it, and then you get perspective and you see, like, yes. oh, it's actually about this.
Sure.
You know, so it is a lot of inside out, because it usually just starts with, like, it's a dick.
Sure. And when you are, I'm interested in this idea of imparting something, and you said it's about sharing your perspective on something. When you're making an hour show, like, one of the things that I feel trips me up a lot as a creative person is, I think, what do I actually have to say about this? Do I need to solve this problem? Like, if I want to, I get caught up in trying to solve the point that I'm talking about,
yeah.
rather than simply saying, here's how I see it.
Yeah, you're not alone in that. I think, I don't know. I think many of us as comedians have delusions of grandeur about, like, how we're all, like, you know, the philosopher, genius, messiahs that the world needs to actually listen to, because it's like, I've got it. I mean, I just had it, and I'm sure I wrote it down on a piece of paper somewhere, but have got it. And like, if you just see this, and if everyone just saw this the way that I saw this, we could fix this already. And then you have to temper that, you know, sort of megalomaniac.
Yes, well, that's interesting. Yeah. I think I meant almost the exact opposite of that, which is I feel like I don't have it. I don't have the answer. And so I don't feel like I give myself permission to talk about the problem because I'm not able to suggest an answer to it.
Oh, interesting.
I think you have answered that question by saying
it's the opposite.
You feel like you do have the answer.
Yeah, I think a lot of times I'm just like, I've got the answer, you guys. But I am fascinated and appreciative of your answer, which is, you know, or the continuation of that is that and that's sometimes an entree into writing a bit or something else is the question rather than the answer. The questions are far more interesting, and to go, I don't have the answer to this. And like the process of not having the answer and trying to look for the answer, or should I look for the answer? Or like, is there any point in answering this anyway? Can be riveting actually, because ultimately you can take us to a lot of different potential answers and then show us why you really don't have the answer. And it's not because you don't have, an answer, it's because you have too many answers, and what is right ultimately.
I feel very empowered now. I think that's a really good point.
I think that is a fascinating perspective from which to write things, is to be like, this is so overwhelming, but also like, I can't stop looking for it, you know?
Yeah. As someone who believes in themselves, how would you best help someone who is listening to this thinking, Jesus, I wish I could believe in myself that much?
I mean,
can that be taught? Can that be transmitted? Is there anything you can
how do you get a person
get that self-belief and just jam it into them? What is that?
Like, I wish that I could tell you the one thing that's gonna like cinch it. I can give you a host of things. Like, so one, you know, there's a whole thing. It's like there's only one you, and you're the only one like you, and whatever, and that's important. But it's like, to me, it's like, there's got to be a reason that I am on this earth right now. And until I found it, I'm going to go look for it. And so that is important. Like, the thing is, like, believe in yourself by going out and doing things and building that belief, right?
So and also, that's a quest as well. I'm going to go out and look for it. And if you frame it as a quest, it's not a competition.
Yes, and you don't need to be good at it. Like, it's great to suck at things. I love taking a class in another art form that I don't do. Like, I'd love taking a painting class. I am shit at painting. But it is wonderful to sit there and be like, I just learned a different skill, or I went to a dance class and I learned something. Oh, that's how you do it. And now that I know how you do it, I realize how much I suck at doing it because it's so far to go. But I also realize that it's a thing that I can build and I could try a little bit more. And it's like, you know, the whole thing about being funny, it's like you can only grow so much, but like funny's funny and all that other stuff. But like, most stuff in the world isn't like that. Most stuff in the world is people going out and figuring out how to do something and enjoying the journey of figuring out how to do something and getting a little bit better and seeing how far that they've come and seeing people come behind them who are where they were and going like, oh, I used to be there and I can tell you what I did because I've mastered a little bit of a thing. And it is exciting. You know, I'm a nerd. It's exciting to learn. It's exciting to be part of a process and to grow and to have some mastery and to be like, oh, but there's still so much more ahead. And like, I can get to that. So I think the believing in yourself is built on deeds and acts and experience and throwing yourself into the places where you wouldn't go. And also sometimes being like, not only am I not good at that, I don't even want to do that. That's great. That's a new thing you've learned, is I don't ever want to do that again. That's awesome. So I think that like, test yourself, you know, is the best way, because yes, we all have inherent worth no matter what we do, and that's an important thing to know. But for many of us, it takes going out and seeking things to find out that the thing that you were looking for was inside you all along.
So magical.
So that was Desiree. You can follow her at DesTheRay. DesTheRay on Twitter, and one would imagine Instagram as well. Go to DesireeBirch.com to find her website. I won't talk about any live dates, but who knows what inspiring and creative things she's currently doing online. Everybody is pivoting. Everybody is trying to find ways to replace their live work, and often their income. For some of us, I mean, I'm one of the lucky ones. I've got this podcast arm. I've got something else that I can lean on and pour my energies into. a lot of comics are circuit comics solely or mainly in to the extent that their income has completely evaporated. I know of one comic who's now working in a factory. He's got a bunch of kids and he couldn't afford to fuck about. So that's a quick pivot of one sort. If you are a comic who is doing something extraordinary or visionary or pioneering in an attempt to make what you normally do happen online somehow, to make it still exist during this crisis, then please get in touch with me, info@comedianscomedian.com. I'm doing some special episodes, as I said, stories of comedians changing and adapting as we all undergo this very painful transformation. So get in touch, please, at ComComPod, at Stu Goldsmith, or info@comedianscomedian.com. I'm going to be chucking content at you from the luxury of my office van, which, if you took part in the Zoom test earlier on, 25 people on the site zoom.us all congregated, and I did a little mini gig at them as a tester, and tremendous fun it was too, so thanks for being part of that. So if you were a part of that, you will have seen the inside of what I'm not going to call the ComCom van just yet, but it's my little mobile recording studio now, parked outside my house and stealing my own Wi-Fi. There we go. I'm not going to post-amble at you just now. I'm talked out. I've got a lot to say. If you want to listen to that that special episode, the one preceding this one, you will hear my thoughts relevant to, I think I recorded that on the 17th of March, and things may have changed by the time you hear this. Look after yourselves. Please be responsible. Educate yourselves about the best way to look after yourselves and everyone else, all the vulnerable people in our society and whatever nation you're in, and do try to stay calm. Try not to give in to fear. It's a scary time, but try to just, this is a ComCom thing, just take a social risk, you know? Just if you're feeling eggy about singing out of your window, do it anyway, and maybe everyone will be singing out their window. All right? Look after yourself. Bye for now.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.